You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 65.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Okay, and we're live. Are you live? Say live for you.
It looks live from this end. It went from off air to live.
All right, great. It's live. All right. Welcome, everyone. You have reached another Local Maximum. And
is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because we're trying to get out of it, aren't we?
Yeah, but in order to get out of it, you have to kind of figure out where you are right now and then sort of think a little differently. So that's what you need the show for.
You have to recognize that you have reached the local maximum.
Right, right. And so, yeah, it's okay to hang out in the local maximum for a little while. It's not going to kill you. Talking about it and trying to think a new way will help you reach another local maximum, and that's what we help you do on the show. So welcome, everyone, to, what is this, episode 65, and my co-host Aaron returns today. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back, 65, just in time for retirement.
Yes. like I said, I've done more local maximum shows than I have did Max and Louise shows at WYBC at Yale. So that's pretty exciting.
Brings back memories.
Yeah. Yeah. You were on that show too, weren't you?
I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure I was in the studio once.
You were.
I think I called in more than once.
Yeah. So another thing that's unprecedented on the show, and by the way, we're going to get to our main topic of the day just before anyone worries that we're not going to do it, and that is going to be how to estimate the probability of an event that has never occurred. So I do want to talk about my previous interviews and a little bit of news before we get into that. If you're just here for the probability thing, I guess you could skip over that. But this stuff is important to me. So first of all, the unprecedented thing that I want to talk about first is the fact that I just did 5 interviews in a row on the local maximum. A lot of people want to be interviewed by this show, so that's pretty cool. Did you listen to them?
I did. Yeah, I've got them all under my belt now, and
that's pretty good.
It's hard to believe that it's been that long since we've done a show together.
Right, right. So I did Hillary Mason on machine learning research. That was very good, and also a little bit about getting into data science and careers, and along the career trajectory. I spoke to Bethany Crystal from Union Square Ventures, and then Mark Sanadella, CEO of The Ladders. So that was a really huge kind of career-oriented episode, which I think is going to help people, anyone who listens to it. I know I wrote some... I changed my resume around a little bit after talking to him. I don't know if I'll ever get to use it, but I probably will eventually. Definitely got me thinking about it a little differently. I don't know.
I've always struggled with what I thought was kind of his number one point with a bullet from that, which was you need to have quantifiable things listed in your experience.
It's way harder.
I made this thing better, or I worked on this project. You need to say how much better you made it, or you know how much more revenue you brought in because of that. And I've always struggled with that because. I'm very much your classic engineer. I go into my engineering silo, and I think that you know revenue and profits and all that's salesperson stuff. I don't have to worry about that, but it's short-sighted to think of it that way. Unfortunately,
yeah. I even have a hard time being like, okay, how am I going to measure my own goals at work? It's something worth thinking about.
Yeah, well, and that's something that they always say when you're in the goal setting process. Is the key to a good goal is to have it be, among several things, something quantifiable. Otherwise, you'll never really be sure if you've attained it.
Yeah, it's quantifiable only like 10% of the time. But I guess that's can you quantify it to quantifiable? Maybe my goal is to make increase the number of quantifiable goals by 20% this quarter.
See, that makes me uncomfortable with how. How slick and salesman-y that starts sounding.
Yeah. All right. And so the other two were more, I guess, news-based and sort of got us into like the moment we're in today with our society and with technology. And they kind of played off each other really well. The first was Facebook versus capitalism, where I spoke to Michael Braunspiegel about how Facebook is, I don't know if I want to make a better word, like attacking his capitalism page. And the other was Denise Hearn with her book, The Myth of Capitalism, talking about the monopolization of big tech. And there were kind of counterpoints to each other. But I think that despite being on way opposite ends of the spectrum, there's kind of a common problem here.
Yeah, those certainly seem to dovetail together. And I knew ahead of time that you were going to be doing that live interview with Denise. And
yeah.
And I expected her to take a very different position, even seeing some of the material that she was going to be presenting. And maybe that's more on me, that I was preparing to take an adversarial position. But while you certainly did not,
I'm also very good at finding common ground. So,
well, yeah, it's you certainly weren't 100% aligned, but there was also a number of things that you very much agreed on. So it's good to establish that at least there's some common ground. We agree on a couple of things, and maybe our solution to this problem isn't the same. Maybe our exact read on what the nature of the problem is not the same. But we recognize a lot of the same symptoms, and we're trying to work towards similar outcomes.
Right.
Even if we don't agree on how to get there.
Sometimes that's a good start. So not in this case, but in other cases, it's not a good start, because even, you know, you hear this all the time. Well, those people understand the problem. They just don't know the solution yet, but their solution is terrible. So, you know, there's not much you can do. But look, I do think the big narrative is, it seems like these big tech giants, these content, social content giants, are seemingly getting more and more powerful. And my prediction is that they're sort of backing themselves into a corner, and eventually they're going to be replaced by a new regime of content services, maybe more decentralized regime. I don't know exactly when that happens. We've examined that idea here in the program yet. I don't want to get today into too much on the solutions, but just yeah, as...
Was it Tim Berners-Lee who was proposing some paths to that kind of a
It was
a
Tim Berners-Lee. And we talked about
among
this.
Among others, certainly.
Yeah, we talked about this in a previous episode. I want to say... it's episode... Now I've got to go look it up.
I sprung that on you, so you got to do some homework on that.
All right, hold on. I'm going to look it up in the archive, because one of the earlier episodes where...
This is what you need a producer for, to do this while you're recording live, or at least a research assistant.
Yeah. All right, so it was called Facebook Data and the Election, Decentralization to the Rescue. So episode 6, we're still talking about this stuff, but that was sort of Chris Dixon's article, who's a VC on how that's going to go. Yeah, and there are a lot of people talking about this and a lot of different ideas on how this is going to all unfold. But I see a lot of smart people sort of saying very similar things. So this is definitely something that we can cover over the next few years.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be coming back. We talked about it in episode 6, and I would expect that
many episodes since
in
then.
Episode 106, we'll still be talking about it.
That's coming up. That's less than a year away. So
a year is a long time when it comes to technology.
Yeah, but not in this issue. I think this issue will still be there. Probably in 4 years. Well, I don't know. I really do believe. I feel that in 5 years. The conversation on this will be totally different. I think in a year it'll probably be the same, but we'll see. We'll hold me to account a year and hold me to account 5 years, and we'll find out. So I just wanted today, before we get into our main topic, to just present a couple articles that I think are like a sign of the times. First is one just from today, which is that, this is an article from NPR, but this is a big news story coming out today. Facebook bans dangerous individuals. Now, you look up the individuals, they are pretty, you know, they're not people that I would say I'm at all aligned with. Sort of white supremacists and Louis Farrakhan and who's that other guy? Alex Jones, who we've talked about on the show. Of all those characters, people tend to have the most visceral reaction to Alex Jones for some reason. Even when compared to the really like the people stoking like religious and racial hatred directly, which I find interesting. But anyway, I just want people to realize, because a lot of people who listen to podcasts, a lot of podcasters are pro free speech. They want to have a lot of voices. Podcasting is very decentralized, based on RSS feeds. So a lot of people listen to podcasts don't realize, you know, why people inside these tech companies are doing it. And so I found a quote from this article that I wanted to, from Media Matters that I wanted to repeat, but then I also want to tell you what my experience is. So the quote is, "The timing is never an accident," Angelo Carusone, president of the liberal organization Media Matters, told the Post. It's interesting that NPR called them out as liberal organization. "The reality is people are getting killed. There are mass shootings and mass murders that are clearly being connected to ideas like white genocide, which are fueling radicalization. The conditions have changed. When you have these massive catalyzing moments that are connected to real life consequences, it put pressure on Facebook and others to look in the mirror." So, I mean, I've been watching the news coverage of a lot of these shootings, and it's really terrible to see, you know, people going into places of worship now. But I feel like people in the tech industry are internalizing this. Like, this is my fault unless I go to my manager or I go to my executives and I say, no, like we can do something about this because our allowing so-and-so to speak is has a causal relationship with these shootings. And I'm not going to get into whether, you know, how to prove or disprove that, but people are definitely internalizing that idea. They see this stuff on the news and they're like, oh my God, that's because of me and we have to do something about it. And free speech or open debate is not really in people's minds right now. And that's where we're at in tech in 2019.
There are a lot of valid concerns on the table there, and I'm going to try really hard to flip my rant switch and flip it right back off in a minute or less. But
okay, give it a shot.
So the problem here is an issue of censorship and when and where that is appropriate. You've got the case of, you know, in Germany you can't publish Mein Kampf, and in New Zealand you can't publish the manifesto or the video feed from the recent mass shooter there, and there are cases when I'm fully on board with choosing not to publish, but mandating not to publish I'm uncomfortable with. So there's something that the media has started to get on board with, which I am fully in support of, and that is in the event of a mass shooting or one of these vehicle attacks
just to jump in for a second. Like, those countries, well, particularly Germany, don't have the same history of, you know, freedom of speech.
They're coming from a very different place than we are. But there is a real concern for glorifying the perpetrator who may or may not be martyring themselves and how that leads to copycats. And in the US, media has started to get on board with choosing, not being mandated, but voluntarily choosing not to publish the name of mass shooters and to not reveal certain details of the events because they feel that it will do more damage than good. And that I am okay
with. I agree with that.
However,
yeah.
Facebook or Google or these other services, they are not a media outlet who chooses what to publish. They are a platform. And so my take would be that they have unless we reassess, redetermine what who's a platform and who's a publisher, that it's not their place to tell us that we can't share this information on that platform. And that's when it becomes censorship as opposed to a journalism or media code of conduct.
But Aaron, it's more than that. It'd be one thing if they say, don't publish the names of the shooters. Don't publish their manifestos. I can get behind that, but I feel like they are taking certain people. And again, not the people that I would say are, you know, in my sphere of what I agree with or what I think is appropriate, but in saying, okay, the fact that these people are getting their ideas out, that's causing that's causing these other horrible things to happen. And even if there's no, like, no obvious connection.
I'm fundamentally a believer that good information will chase out bad, and that the truth will chase out lies eventually. And it may be a messy process, but if you try and force it by blocking the bad information, you drive it underground, and it becomes more powerful.
But not only that, it's we're not the one who's blocking this stuff. Essentially, we're giving that power to actors like Facebook and now YouTube, Google.
Well, sure. And so apparently they've adopted a worldview that is not that the truth will win out eventually, and that open debate and discussion is the way to get there.
But
they've decided that either their audience or their platform is too weak to do that, and so they need to stack the deck in favor of what they believe to be the right outcome.
Yeah, but what I wanted to say on that is that they are, you know, what makes us think that anyone giving some large, essentially, as we've been saying, monopolized group that power is going to end well? Like, they're going to use it in the appropriate way.
Oh, absolutely, it won't. Like,
and how does this end? Because anyone who thinks this ends, that this has a happy ending, I just don't see how you can't think more than two steps ahead.
Even if everybody in that role right now is well-intentioned and pure of heart, then that just means that they're setting up a mechanism that can easily be co-opted by somebody who is less so in the future.
Oh, yeah, and it will. So another one that I wanted to post, and I'm just going to quickly go by these for lack of time, but from an article from a month ago that the YouTube executives ignored warnings and let toxic videos run rampant. There's a lot of negative publicity on their algorithm. Apparently the charge is that it leads people to more and more radical content. But again, the whole media narrative and the discussions that people are having inside these companies are not how do we have a free and open debate here. The discussion is, oh my God, we're causing horrible things to happen. It's all our fault. Or if you're a journalist, it's all your fault. You know, and it's like, it's become a moral crusade start. I said this at the end of episode 61 with Michael Braunspiegel of Capitalism. Like, you know, everyone hates Facebook, but there's two groups. There's people who hate Facebook who are not because, you know, they're like blocking you or whatever. But the dominant narrative is no, Facebook, I hate Facebook because they're not blocking enough. And so people sort of see, I hate Facebook, you hate Facebook, maybe we could be friends, but whoa, this is a case where you're taking things in a totally different direction.
Well, it's the Brexit problem all over again. They had a majority of people who supported Brexit, but they didn't realize until after the vote that they agreed on, yes, we want Brexit, but they vehemently disagreed on what type of Brexit they wanted. And so that's why they haven't been able to actually come to an agreement on how they're going to do it. So they're stuck.
I don't know if we have time to dive into that analogy.
No, I'm going to throw that grenade and run away, and we'll deal with it at another time.
All right. Do we have anything else to talk about on this topic before we move on to move on to probability and
I'll mention two things really quickly.
Okay.
One is actually, it's a podcast that I listen to, but he also has a YouTube channel. It's Popular Front, and he covers conflicts and war zones around the world that aren't necessarily getting mainstream media coverage. And part of that is he's made a number of documentaries and sharing, you know, footage from places like the Ukraine or Syria or Iraq and Afghanistan, where he's done field reporting. And apparently YouTube has chosen to block him from monetizing his channel, claiming that it depicts violence, which is not inaccurate. There are violent things happening in those videos because he's reporting from a war zone. But his counterpoint is nothing that I'm posting in these documentaries is any more violent or more controversial than what you're seeing on like the BBC or Sky News or CNN. It's just that I'm one guy freelancing in the world of conflict journalism versus a huge multimedia or, you know, multinational corporation. And so I'm unable to make a penny off of this while they're just rolling in the dough. And it's unfair that not only can he not monetize it, but he can't even get a response from YouTube trying to straighten this out. So I don't have an answer to that. Just an example of another case where the censorship is, whether it's real people making those decisions or the algorithm, it's doing so with an uneven hand.
Yeah.
And we'll throw a link into another article about concerns on the side of Instagram. I guess they handed down some new standards for how they're going to censor and moderate their material. But there are some serious concerns about how that's going to be implemented, and that it's going to be uneven and going to have a disproportionate effect or a lower threshold for what gets censored for women compared to men, particularly on the matter of sexually suggestive or indecent material.
All right. I think that this, we can come back to this in a future episode where we can go through all the socials.
Yeah, this is not
going to
be solved anytime soon. So it's ripe for a return.
I think we go through all the socials and go through the specific problems that they're having and compare and contrast. That would be a good show. But for now, let's get back into the question that I think you brought this question up.
Onto the main topic.
Yeah. So what are the strategies for coming up with for estimating the probability of an event that has never occurred before? Now, before we dive into it, I want to ask you, this question, I think you originated it. I don't know if you did or I did, but if it was you, was there something that prompted that question in your head? Or was it just
random? I can't think of a specific event that I want to be able to predict, but more so just the whole concept of black swan events. And maybe maybe you're going to kind of bootstrap a little bit to it this way, but I kind of break it into two different categories. There are these, it's never occurred before, just straight up never. And then there's the, it's never occurred before in my lifetime. So from my perspective, it's functionally never occurred before, but we may be able to get some information on it from a historical context.
Yeah. So first of all, I think, you should try to be able to, this is not an impossible question. Like we talked about subjective probability in episode 21. So you should be able to come up with a personal kind of a probability measure. You could try to measure in your head, what is the likelihood of an event happening? If that probability is important to you, you should be able to try to estimate it. And there are some strategies that I'm going to go through now. I'm not going to go through like the mathematics of it. I'm going to go through a little bit of the philosophy of it and a little bit of the overall techniques of events that have never occurred. But first of all, I want a little thinking point for you, Aaron. And the first statement I want to make is every event that you could think of that you want to estimate the probability for has never occurred before. There is no probability that you could give me for an event that that has occurred before, and the reason is that try to think of a counterexample.
Well, so I guess we're this may be getting a little semantic, but
it is. But we need to do. Let's dive into it. Come on.
You're saying that if something has occurred before, then. It has occurred. And maybe I should rephrase it as, what is the probability of something occurring again that has occurred before?
Well, the thing is, it never occurs in exactly the same way. Even like something is going to be different. For example, the timestamp when it occurs,
Okay, so this gets into the whole philosophical, you can never step into the same river twice.
Exactly. And you could never, if you think of something very deterministic, like rolling a die, right? If I roll a die right now, it's a different event than all the die rolls that you've seen in the past. And so it's my current roll of the die is an event that's never is an event that hasn't happened yet, and it hasn't occurred before. And so you're still estimating, okay, what's the probability of 3 is going to come up? You're still going to say 1/6. But you are instead kind of lumping it in with other die rolls that you've heard about. And so it is, and especially in the real world, I want to return to this idea of there's definitely a spectrum here. And let me get to this in a minute. I have a couple more thinking questions to go into before I dive into that. The second thinking question is that an event that has already occurred has probability one. And so this is another mind-bending thing. Because let's say I rolled a rolled that die and a three came up. And I asked you, what is the probability that I just rolled a three? Well, the answer is one. 100% sure that I just rolled a three because it's already happened.
Assuming that you have perfect knowledge.
Right. So the probability is actually a little bit less than one because you might have gotten fake news. You might have someone wrote it down wrong, or you might not believe your lying eyes or something like that. But
where this could come into play significantly is in the historical record.
Right. That
we may say, well, this happened. And we believe it happened because of these primary sources and this physical evidence, but are we absolutely sure that this is actually what happened and that there is no other alternative explanation for where that evidence came from?
Right.
But yes, from a philosophical point of view, if something has happened, then the probability of that event is indeed one. Yes.
Right. But that sort of gives us an interesting... So let's suppose that I'm walking down the street in... let's say I visit Cleveland, and I'm walking down the street in Cleveland, and all of a sudden I see you there. And I'm like, Aaron, I didn't know you're in Cleveland. I didn't know you're walking down the street. What are the odds? And you'd be like, the odds are 100% because it just happened.
But that's a useless... Well, that's a functionally useless piece of information. What would be useful is if... 60 seconds before you saw me, someone posed you the question, what are the odds of you running into Aaron on the street in the next 60 seconds?
Yes.
And you would make a prediction. That's useful information.
And that's often what we're talking about.
But once you see me, you update that to, oh, well, the probability of that is 100% because it's already happened.
Yeah. So, right. So oftentimes when we talk about the probability of events occurring, it's the probability... It's you kind of have to think about this a little bit. It's a little bit of a mind game, but it's really your subjective probability of the event occurring given the information that you had and the techniques that you had before the event occurred.
Yeah. So from a Bayesian point of view, that Cleveland scenario, it was Cleveland, right?
I don't know why I chose Cleveland. There must have been a reason.
So you completely unexpectedly encounter me in Cleveland one
day. Yeah.
And you've... So, yes, there's 100% chance now that you have encountered me in Cleveland on that day at that time.
Right. Only because I've never been there.
But that information is of very little use, except for the fact that now if you were to ask the question, what are the odds that I encounter Aaron in Cleveland again tomorrow, given that I saw him there today? Well, you're going to give that a much higher probability now than you would have prior to that encounter in Cleveland.
Well, yeah, because I know you're there.
Right.
So in that case,
it's useful, but again, it's of questionable use in looking backwards in time.
Right.
I guess Bayesian approach is a very limited use looking in that direction.
No. What you kind of have to do is you kind of have to take yourself, when you go backward in time, you could do it, but you have to sort of take yourself back and you have to say, okay, what was the information that I had available at that time, and then the interesting probability number that you want is based off of that information, not the information that you have now. So, you could do what you want. If I say, oh, the chances are, I don't know, 1 in 10,000, then that makes sense of a number as a number, but it's not my probability now. It was my probability then. If that makes any sense,
right? And certain events are of varying levels of independence. So, in that example, you running into me on the street in Cleveland one day has a the odds of you running into me in Cleveland the following day are much more dependent on that outcome than the odds of you rolling a six if you just rolled a six. Unless we've got some strange quantum intertwining going on here.
Let's say no.
Those are completely independent.
Yeah.
And so that information doesn't really transit through time in any meaningful fashion there.
Yeah. So like I said, there's kind of a spectrum of events. And now, you know, the chance of a second meeting, well, the second meeting has never occurred before either, even though the first meeting has never occurred before. Also, the second meeting has never occurred before. Like I said before, all events are events that has never occurred before. So when I break down this question, I actually think that I'm not saying that your question has no meaning. I'm just trying to figure out what the meaning is, because if we take it too literally, then it has no meaning. And so I want to figure out what the meaning of the question really is. So I kind of see it as a spectrum where, you know, a dice roll or most casino games are on one end of the spectrum where you know the physical properties of the system. You know, there are six sides, two sides of a coin, 52, you know, how many rolls of the wheel, 52 cards, all that stuff. And so, and you can get at those probabilities two ways. You could either, you know, roll the die many times and then sort of figure out the probability that way, or you just know the physical probabilities of the die and just say it's all, each side is approximately 1/6. But even though those events, each individual roll or whatever is an event that has never occurred before, that's not the event that you're talking about, because those kind of all get lumped into the same type of event. And so,
right, you can kind of work your way back from it in that,
right,
yes, we potentially live in a universe with infinite branching universes off of it. However, we're only interested in the particular question we're asking. So if the case is, I'm going to roll a die, a six-sided die, and
yeah,
and we want to know what the chance of a given number coming up on it is. Well, there's, It's a unique occurrence if it rolls a six, given, you know, every other variable that's currently evolving in the universe around it. There could be many cases where I roll a six, which are all unique and have never happened before. But in the context of that question, it only matters, is it rolling a six or not?
Right.
So you can kind of collapse that universe back down somewhat into the particular cases we're interested in.
Well, to think about it another way, and
assuming that none of those other things influence that.
Right.
Which, to some extent, is true.
Yeah. In episode 57, I talked about the idea of using analogies, an argument by analogy, to try to figure out what the, what the probability of something is. And each roll of the die is completely analogous to another one. And so that's sort of what I used. And I think what you're looking at are events that maybe have no obvious analogy associated with them, and so you can say they've never occurred before. So, like you said, something completely unexpected, a black swan. There's also like events that have never occurred before, but let me ask you about this event, and I have it further down a little bit. But what is the probability of a meteor striking a city, and let's say we have some threshold doing X amount of damage or X amount of casualties, that has never happened before. Is that the type of event that you're thinking about?
That could be one. The classic example that I've, and I'm trying to remember which podcast I heard about this on, but I feel like it's come up numerous times in the last few months, is the Trinity nuclear test.
Okay.
So this was the first man-made nuclear detonation. It was in New Mexico, and part of the concern, because they'd never had this type of reaction before. There was a theory that it would literally catch the atmosphere on fire and
ooh,
destroy the Earth. Much like when the Large Hadron Collider was turned on, and there was a non-zero chance that this could create a black hole that would end existence as we know it.
Slow down. Explain
this. I believe
this.
That was the Large Hadron Collider.
I never heard of this before.
Oh, well, now I'm going to have to do the research on it.
Well, that's crazy, man. Okay. Okay. I'm doing some chemical reaction, some nuclear reaction. I don't know. Well, look, I don't know the physics of it, so I obviously can't give a specific answer. But those are also, let's just say, okay, those are also the type of things we want to know. Can this destroy the Earth? Obviously, the Earth has never been destroyed before. Another example I give here is the probability of an American living to 120 in the next 20 years. So I looked up a list of oldest people. I think probably there's been an American who's lived to 120, but not verified. So that is an interesting question. Because there's a lot of factors that could go into that. First of all, there are certainly plenty of people who are over 100, right, who can live that long. There's no evidence that suggests it's impossible to live that long, other than it hasn't happened yet. That's another one that we want to estimate. So, again, without diving into these particular examples, and again, if someone has some specific insight into these specific examples, I'd like to hear about it, localmaxradio@gmail.com. But I want to also refer to episode 57 again, because the way that we get to these things is we're always looking for analogies. That's the only way that we know things. And I kind of go back to this. I don't think I've spoken to you directly about this, Aaron, but I kind of go back to like the main assumption that I always have to make, and that assumption is that there is some regularity in the universe. And so by that, I mean that analogies sometimes work, is another way to put it. Not that the whole universe is regular. You know, I'm sure you've heard of the Einstein, like, God doesn't play dice, or God does play dice, right?
Well, I suppose another way to look at this would be...
Well, hang on, just to finish my point. I'm not saying God plays dice or God doesn't play dice. I'm not taking it... a position on that. The only position that I'm taking is that there's some regularity. Like if you look at a picture, like each pixel is somehow related to the pixels around it. Not always. You could have a random pixel, but if each pixel has no relationship to any pixel around it, you essentially have a picture with no information.
White noise.
Right, right. And so a universe that's organized in any other way other than analogies sometimes work is no universe at all. It's a universe of no information. And therefore, I think I could safely make that assumption. And so that's sort of the foundation of kind of my philosophical outlook right now. And then I could say, okay, analogies sometimes work. Then we could start talking about which analogies work, which analogies don't work. And that's where you can get into trouble.
But, yeah, go ahead. It's just an extrapolation of the laws of thermodynamics that entropy is a fact of the universe, and it's moving in one direction. And while in a certain zone, you may be able to push it in the opposite direction, you can't push the universe as a whole in the opposite direction. That everything is always moving towards entropy. I think that by extension means that yes, there has to be some sort of regularity in the universe, and the corollary that
otherwise we can't have a conversation.
That this regularity, if you draw a box around something within that universe, there's no guarantee that the regularity holds within that.
Yeah,
but the system as a whole will.
Right. So you have to have some. So yeah, like I said, if you're talking about a picture, right? Not every pixel on the picture is going to make sense or going to have some formula for it, but you could say, hey, is a pixel more likely to be the same color as a pixel next to it? I would say yes. Like just looking at my face here on the YouTube video, like if I have the blue pixel on my shirt, well, it's actually a blob of blue. So, there are, there are pixels there that are the same. That's how image recognition works. The words we use, the text we use, they're not random.
An example we've talked about in a previous context, the idea of like a 100-year storm.
Right.
You could have 200-year storms in a 100-year period. Hell, you could have 200-year storms in a 10-year period. And that doesn't break the rules. But if you expand your view to a long enough time frame, then yes, it will appear that they're happening on average every 100 years. Either that, or you've messed up your scale for what a 100-year storm is based on bad input data.
Sure. If you could say, well, there's climate change, then you could say, well, the game has changed. And so you could have that argument as well. So it gets a little dicey in there. I want to give I have a few more examples written down here, and we can go through each one. One I actually pulled from this book, which we spoke about on episode 0. It's the theory that would not die on Bayes' rule. And I actually went into, there's a chapter in here about, you know, after World War II, the academia was very frequentist. Bayes' rule wasn't really used. And the area where it was used, and this was recognized by a guy named Arthur Bailey, was in insurance. Well, why insurance? Well, you have to use what works in the insurance company. And so they had to incorporate priors.
Otherwise, you go out of business.
Right, exactly. And so they had to incorporate priors. And one interesting example it goes into is, you know, and this came up at a company's Christmas party that was like insurance company in North America. It's funny, in the book they said it was the, like, the CEO or something was dressed as Santa and asked someone that this while they were drunk. But I don't know if that was, if that's, I could have written that wrong. Or maybe he said, I'd rather not give you an answer on after a few martinis or something like that. But anyway, he asked, so they're insuring airlines, right? And so he asked, well, what's the probability of a mid-air collision of two planes? Never happened before. Two planes colliding in mid-air
certainly not in commercial flight.
Right, right. And so it essentially, the probability would go to zero, or they didn't know what to do. But this statistician, Longley Cook was his last name, he was looking at the problem, and he decided, no, the probability is actually non-zero, and therefore we're not charging enough for this type of insurance. And he actually extrapolated based on, you know, other types of safety malfunctions, and also the projected increase in plane traffic over the next 10 years of how often this type of thing could occur. And he guessed that there would be 0 to 4 such collisions in the next 10 years if they raise their rate. And yeah, the first such collision actually occurred in New York City 2 years after he made that projection. That I assume that the insurance company acted on that, so it probably saved their bottom line. But
so thinking about this from an insurance point of view,
yeah,
brings back to mind another never happened before black swan event that is worth looking at the odds of, and that's, what are the odds of me dying? And not yes, I realize that, well, barring the singularity, the odds of that are 100%. I will eventually. But
speak for yourself, Aaron. Speak for yourself.
The question of, when will I die? And it's not that people haven't died before, or people with very similar traits to myself, but I, as an individual, have not died before, as evidenced by the fact that I'm talking to you now. So that is an unprecedented event that it would be valuable for me to know when that is going to happen, or what the odds of that happening at certain intervals are.
Well, Aaron, this is exactly what I'm talking about.
Actuarial science, yeah.
Yeah, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you are saying, well, this is an event that has never occurred, but because I have this analogy to all these other people, I'm actually can make a prediction on that. Now, I think you mentioned the singularity. That's an interesting monkey wrench that can be thrown into the,
I suppose that is another thing that has never happened before.
Exactly.
So that's really at the core of all this futurism and prediction. Is
right. Well, I don't
how
think,
do you assess things that haven't happened
before? I don't think people
for
know
a certain
what we're
degree of
yeah.
haven't happened before.
Exactly. And that's the idea behind a local maximum. You don't get out of a local maximum. So a local maximum, like we're saying, is when you are here, the local maximum. When you're on this hill and you want to get to that hill, walking in the same direction that you were before, you're kind of stuck in your same mindset. And just by making analogies to the same things that you did before are not going to get you to the higher plane of understanding. So
yeah, you have to go downhill or change gears
or
whatever,
yeah.
whatever metaphor you want to use for yeah. coming off of that peak.
Yep. All right. So let me give you another example of something that I've run into of something that's never happened before, but you could still kind of you could still get a good estimate for the probability. And I don't know if you've played a lot of these old video games where you can you have different levels, and then when you die, you have to go back to the beginning. A lot of kind of the old arcade type games. And so, have you ever tried, Aaron, to beat like two levels of the video game? And you either save your win on level one, or whenever you like lose a life or whatever on level one, you're like, "Damn, I'm going to start over and have a perfect level one before even going to level two." And then, so you've never actually played level two directly. You've either saved it or you just kept playing level one until you won. And so you've beaten both levels individually. But then I say, okay, I'm going to have you play one time. What's your what's the probability that you can win this game as a whole? By the way, the thing I'm picturing in my mind, there are a few things I'm picturing in my mind. I'm picturing kind of a simpler one maybe for this one. Let's think of, I don't know if you didn't have a Nintendo growing up, did you?
I did not.
Okay. But you know Mike Tyson's Punch Out when like, okay, if I beat Glass Joe and then I beat Von Kaiser, you know, those are actually two easiest ones, but usually you're further along in the game when you have, you know, if I could beat this boxer and then this boxer, but I saved my game, so I never actually beat both of them I never actually beat both of them in sequence. I've only beat them individually because I saved my game. Another one I'm thinking of, the NES Ninja Turtles. Oh, that was so hard. The last level.
I don't think I played the NES one, but I know I played an arcade
version. NES, you can't save. Punch Out, you could save because they had the codes. The Ninja Turtles, I could only beat that when later on I had an emulator that I was able to save it on a PC. but that game, that last level is impossible. I had to basically do it little bits at a time and then save every single, and then like some of them I tried 100 times. Okay, I got like 3 yards further. All right, but anyway. So let's suppose you're playing Punch-Out and you got two boxers that you beat one after another. And so what are some assumptions that you could make to try to estimate, okay, what's the probability that I could beat both of these boxers in one go? And so one assumption you might make is that a win on each level is independent. You know, hey, I beat this boxer 10% of the time. I beat this other one 5% of the time. So, you know, therefore it's going to be, ooh, what does that come out to? You multiply those together and now, okay, I have a 0.5% chance of winning
odds,
them.
Odds are not good.
Odds are not good in your favor. No. Okay. Then you ask the question, is a win on each level? So you could do that. But then you realize that's not the whole story. And I think we could do better. So one is that, I'm basing this probability on all my past games, right? I've learned. I get better and better each time I play. Or maybe it's been 3 months since I've played, and maybe I've gotten worse. So
and we're assuming that the game isn't also learning and getting better.
In these games, it would not.
Similarly, these games, as far as I'm aware, you basically reset in between levels. It's not like you're carrying over any sort of strength buff or health, you know, depletion in health that you incurred in the previous level.
Right. So you could take into account that maybe my stats from before I've played this one time are off, either from me learning or from time passing and me not learning, losing it.
Yeah, well, you've talked about that in the context of Foursquare before, that you have a database of ratings going back to the beginning, the first time that venue was rated.
Yeah.
But maybe they've changed their menu, or they have a new chef,
sure,
or it's under new management. And so you want to de-weight some of the early ratings, perhaps with more in favor of recent ones.
Yeah.
So that you don't have too much of a...
Yeah.
A skew there, a bias.
And in this case, we could maybe make an assumption. There are a few assumptions we could build in, like maybe I'm more likely to get better by playing more than get worse. I think that's a fair assumption. Things like that. But
you may also be more likely to get tired if you're playing two levels in sequence and have decreased performance.
Absolutely. Timing
compared
matters.
Compared to playing them independent.
Right. And so...
Or you might get into the groove.
Right. And so that's a question. Let's say there's 10% chance I beat this bad guy, and 5% chance I beat this other bad guy. It's the punch out guys are always portrayed as bad guys, but I mean, it's just a game. I don't know. But anyway, that game was really weird. They were very like ethnic stereotypes, very racially insensitive.
Yeah,
game.
It's but could not and perhaps should not be made today.
No, definitely not. So another question is, are the two levels independent if I have to play them in sequence? And I think they're somewhat close to independent, but not entirely independent. And then we could think of ways in which they might break independence. So, for example, again, like you said, I could be tired or I could be really focused. And so if I beat the first guy and there's a 10% chance, maybe beating the second guy isn't a 5% chance. Maybe that goes up to 10% at that
point. Does it give you psychological or some other form of momentum?
Right.
If there's not momentum built into the stats engine of the game, but into the user input side.
Right, exactly. And so there could be a number of things that make them not independent. So consider those as well. There's so many things that you could put into a statistical model. You oftentimes can't put all of them in that you want to. You often have to pick, okay, these are the important things that I want to consider. And after that, the cost of incorporating more information exceeds the benefit I get by getting a potentially more accurate probability. Okay, so what do we learn from that example? I think one is you can break the event down into several sub-events, maybe A and B. They have never occurred together, but maybe they have both occurred independently, and at least there's some semblance of independence. Or if they're not independent, you could sort of imagine how they're not independent. You could have some working hypotheses on how they're not independent. So again, coming back to the meteorite striking a city, we have records going way back when and where meteorites strike the Earth and how destructive they are. And we know where our cities are and what percentage of the world they cover today. So we have those two data sets. So they're cities existing, that's an easy one, and meteorite strikes happening, but we have them going back like on a geologic scale, not in modern history. We have a little bit in modern history. There's one in Russia, but very, very few. And so I think you can get a more accurate number there. Again, I haven't calculated these numbers directly, so it's going to be very small. But you can get a number as to how likely that will be in any given year, say. And another extreme example that I wanted to mention was Gelman's paper. Gelman is a statistician at Columbia. He publishes a lot of statistical conversations now come back to a lot of Gelman's work because he publishes so much stuff and so many like books and stuff. So you often hear that name. But one of his papers...
Is this the same Gelman of the Gelman amnesia effect fame?
I don't know.
I want to say it's not because I feel like that was the work of two different people. There was a gel and a man, not one guy.
Oh, no, yeah. No, this is Andrew Gelman. I've read some of his books and some of his papers, but the reason why I found this was it was a paper entitled, Estimate the Probability of an Event That Has Never Occurred. But the specific event he was talking about was, what's the probability of your vote affecting the outcome of an election? And I think in that particular election he was looking at was like one out of a 10 million or something like that. It might have been the presidential election. I'm not sure. It is interesting because you can break down the probability for each individual voter, maybe. And so that gives you a big probability distribution of how all the other voters are going to act. So how many non-voters are there? What's the probability of one non-voter, two non-voters, three non-voters? Or what's the probability of having five voters or six voters or seven voters in the election? I assume there's a probability that no one shows up for any given election. I believe that's actually happened in very small, like, special elections before, where no one showed up, not even the candidates, in like very small towns. Where, but in the presidential election, the probability on that is probably pretty low. It basically means that the world has ended, probably. But it's probably around the probability of that. Okay, there's probability of how many.
Say that this is really an analysis of there can only be one deciding vote. And so it's really a question of
there has to be an even number of
how many people are going to show up to vote.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, you also have prior knowledge of how you're going to choose to vote.
Right.
And if you're which side of that divide you might fall on. Although I guess it really doesn't matter which way you're choosing to vote if it's tied 50-50 and then you step into the booth. Because that's the only scenario where your vote would make a difference.
Right. And so, they actually estimated a probability for this event that has not occurred and probably for the presidential election will never occur. I don't know what they do if the vote is literally tied. So, but I assume it was based on the fact that,
they recount until it isn't.
Right. So that your state is, well, that's another thing that they didn't take into account with the fuzziness of our counting. But let's assume that it's the probability that your state is tied and your state decides the Electoral College winner. And there's a non-zero probability of that. And that's an event that's never occurred and almost certainly will never occur in our lifetime. Or probably will never occur ever, I'm thinking.
Puts into perspective the good odds of participating in a lottery.
Yeah, it came pretty damn close with Florida in 2000, though.
And you could say that election was decided by single vote, except it was the vote of one particular Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit different because going in, there are only nine of them. So there are a relatively common, or it's relatively common, at least in the modern era, to have four or five decisions.
Sure. Yeah, in any small election.
And there could be a debate about who is actually the swing vote, who is that fifth vote, whether it's because of how they swing ideologically or who announces last. I don't even know how they decide that. I can't. Well, they all sign on to
Opinions.
To opinions. So it's there's no blind ballot. I can't imagine that they also they must in turn, whether it's in order of certainty or in order of seniority or something, go around and announce how they're choosing to take their position.
Yeah, I think they talk to each other.
Yeah, on three, everybody anyway. Either put your hand up or hold it down.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. They work with each other for a long time, so they kind of have a system going, I suppose. So another couple of examples that look similar, but they're actually very different. So one is the example that Nassim Taleb always gives in his writing, and that's like the well-being of the turkey. So assume that you are a Thanksgiving turkey. And you don't know when Thanksgiving is, and you don't know how long a year is. And so as the year goes on, your well-being gets better and better and better. But you can't really extrapolate that because at one day, the game's over. Your Thanksgiving dinner. And so...
Well, right. This goes almost directly counter to the principle you were talking about in the context of predictions, that if something has gone on for X period of time, it is likely to go on for an additional X period of time.
Well, not quite, because let's say you're the turkey, but you don't know how long a year is. And so you're like, at first you're like, oh, crap, maybe a year is 30 days. And then 30 days goes by and you go, I guess a year is longer than 30 days, but you wouldn't, your best bet wouldn't immediately be like, oh, it's probably 35. You might actually extend that. Oh, in fact, your best bet is to think that a year is double of the amount that you've already lived, to assume that you're about halfway through it. So yes, your expected lifespan grows, but it grows slowly, it grows linearly. And then you know that the gig is up eventually, so that's that's how fast it grows. Now, another example is, when will I get a response to this email? I don't know if you've experienced this, but like you go one day, 2 days, a week, 2 weeks, and then eventually you start thinking, huh, I'm never going to get a response to this email. It's not like if I wait a month, you're like, well, I'll probably get a response in 2 months, or I wait a year, I'll probably get a response in another year. No, the probability just quickly goes to zero. Like, this is an event that will never happen. And so there's one that veers one way, and there's one that veers another way. I mean, the probability of an event not occurring the next day grows in each case, but they grow in very different ways. In the turkey's case, it grows a little bit. Like, I'm a little less likely to die today than yesterday than I was today, because I think a year might be longer. But in the case of the email, no, I'm way less likely as the days go by. I'm way less likely to ever receive a response to this email. So that's another one. Are you in the turkey situation? Are you in the email situation? And if you're in the turkey situation, like I said, the turkey might assume that the year is, well, if the turkey doesn't know that there's a Thanksgiving, then you're in a problem. It might think it's an email situation. Things getting better and better. And so that's another thing to watch out for. But can you estimate, you know, when that event is going to happen? Like, let's say, well, I know for certain it's not 10,000 days. So, you know, maybe you can extrapolate based on that. Again, very hand wavy, but it's just, do you see what I'm saying? Two very different situations. You have to figure out which one you're in.
I think the metaphor kind of falls apart when I try and ask this question.
Okay, go for it.
So if you're the turkey,
yeah.
How do you know that? I mean, what can you take in as, what inputs do you get in that situation to identify whether you're a turkey or an email?
Right, exactly, and it depends on the situation.
Because in the email case, I have sent and received emails before, so I can make a pretty good assessment there. But if I'm the turkey, I haven't lived and died before, so I don't know what if I'm a turkey.
Aaron, you answered your question earlier in the show when you talked about actuarial tables. So there you go.
It's not a satisfying answer,
though. No. Okay, so to wrap up, I want to come back to way back to episode one, if you remember that, where we tackled a very similar issue. And that was, you know, when there was a Hawaii missile scare and there was an accidental alarm going off that there is a nuclear missile incoming to the area. Well, we asked, well, what is your prior probability of that happening? And that was essentially trying to come up with a probability of for something that has never occurred. And so, again, I think it's similar to the case with the guy who had to figure out the probability of two planes colliding midair. Not that there's going to be 0 to 4 cases of that happening in the next 10 years. Just sort of similar in approach. Where we can look at historical analogies, and you sort of want to understand the mechanism for how and why that might happen. And I think the bottom line is you're not completely stuck. There are techniques to do this, and the techniques are analogies, breaking it up into a sequence of events that all have to happen, or that maybe have better analogies and that have happened before, and then combining them, and then trying to use your experience to figure out whether they're independent or not, and try to estimate how things change over time. And that's the approach I could take. I don't know. I feel like I gave many approaches here. So if you ever run into this problem before, I know it's not organized in a nice little checklist that you might get from a textbook, but that kind of concludes my initial discussion of it. So what do you think?
Well, the last example you brought up with the ICBMs, it reminds me of there's a saying that I'm probably poorly paraphrasing, but it's something to the effect of we've never invented a weapon that we haven't then used in war. And the
that's a very ominous.
The unspoken counter to that is, except for all the ones we haven't used yet. So,
right.
For example, nuclear ICBMs as a single data point.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That doesn't,
It only holds true with the caveat that except for all the cases where it isn't true.
That means it's not true.
Which makes for a weak argument.
I mean,
but it's a catchy phrase.
Yeah, but you could use a time box on it, like within 100 years or something.
Well, right, because so that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah.
In terms of if we wanted to estimate the likelihood, you know, is there a consistent window on the time between, you know, development of a technology and its use as a weapon that we can see as a trend over history. And of course, you can't just take the numbers on that. It's, you know, are we in an era where history is literally accelerating? And but that's kind of how you would have to potentially approach.
So here's a question: is the ICBM a turkey or an email?
Ooh. I hope it's an email. I think.
I hope it's an email. Yes, then that bodes well. But
I mean, the Cold War,
yeah.
the mutually assured destruction has so far proven to be an email that has never gotten a response.
It could be an email in the short to medium term, but turkey in the long term.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well. Hopefully, we will not live to see that long term. all right. Any other last thoughts before we talk about what we're heading into the next few weeks?
I don't know. We hit a real dark note there. So maybe it's not on brand for us. But perhaps that's a good place to go out.
Okay. Next week, it looks like I might be talking to Dennis Crowley again at Foursquare. So that'll be fun. I'll talk about some of the new location-based technologies that they're coming out with, and maybe talk to him about his labs project. So that could be fun.
It'll be interesting to see your take on it as now a Foursquare outsider.
Right. Outsider coming into their office. I even asked him, like, hey, this is the conference room that I like to record in, so can you get this conference room?
Are they going to have to, like, give you a visitor badge when you come in? Or?
No. It's too small of an office for that. Like, the people at the front desk know me. And,
well, you see, I'm showing my biases. I'm used to working in a government and military context.
Yeah.
Not only do I need a visitor badge, but I need an escort everywhere I go.
Yeah. So I had a few topics I want to discuss. Obviously, come back to the tech news. A few more of these probability and statistics ones. Man, this is interesting. I think this is going to get a good response and a lot of follow-up questions to go over.
I like talking about this. My only wish would be that, and because it's a complicated issue, it's tough to do this, but to have, like you were saying, like a checklist or, you know, a proceed from steps 1 through 6 and you will have successfully estimated the odds of this never before event.
No, that's if we're writing an article, we should come up with one of them. But I actually feel like someone could actually listen to this podcast episode and come up with that article. So that might work.
We're gonna put that on the whiteboard for Local Maximum, the book, and when that goes to print, that'll be a chapter.
Yeah. I'm serious. When I have some time off. All right. Great. Show notes at localmaxradio.com/65. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to the Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
And she said, I don't care what you say, you're gonna see me shine.
Your Hangout on Air will now be broadcast on YouTube, a broadcast for up to 8 hours. Okay?
I don't think I have that kind of stamina.
No, I don't think so either.